Hello and welcome to Take Off, a Points and Miles podcast by 10X Travel. I'm your host, Bryce. Today I'm joined by Travis and a very special guest, a return guest, I will say, our own social media manager, LaVon Edwards. LaVon, how are you doing this morning?
Doing pretty good. How are you guys doing?
Doing well, thanks. I guess we should ask, is it even morning where you are right now? And LaVon lives what is perhaps the most enviable life, at least of the 10X Travel staff, maybe of the Points and Miles world. LaVon, you've been kind of traveling almost indefinitely for the past few years, always somewhere new and exciting. Where do we find you today?
This is definitely one of my more random locations. I'm actually in Tbilisi, Georgia. Just got here last week. I haven't really explored it or anything yet, but so far it has been very nice.
What made you want to visit Georgia?
So the cost of living is very attractive here. There's also a lot to do. So yes, I figured why not go explore, you know, see a new country.
It's one of those places where everyone, the few people I know who've been there just rave about it. So have such great things to say about Georgia.
So far, the food has been pretty good here.
That's like number one priority on my list. So
agreed. Agreed. We could do many podcasts on the adventures of LaVon, and maybe will at some point, but today's focus is going to be perhaps the one that I would put first on that list. We're going to be talking all about safaris on Points and Miles, hearing about LaVon's experience on a recent safari to Kenya, and really just addressing a question that we get all the time from readers who see the social media images, YouTube videos of safari, and like, I want to do that, myself included in that group. So we're going to talk all about it, how to do it, hear about LaVon's experience. And I do want to give a special thanks to listener Sophia S. for writing in to request this awesome topic. Please, all of you listening, feel free to do the same. Tell us what you want to hear on future episodes. We want to do what we can to give the shows and topics that you want, and you know, selfishly that I want here as well on this one for my own purposes. But today is all about safaris. But before we dive in, couple quick reminders. If you are new to Points and Miles, be sure to check out episodes 1 through 6 of this podcast for some of the fundamentals. You got to get those in place first before you can think about accomplishing some of the amazing things that we're going to hear about on today's show. And of course, be sure to sign up for My10X. That's our free tool. Helps you save money on travel by getting more out of your points and miles. You can see and manage all of your credit cards, points and miles in one place. Learn how to earn and redeem miles like a pro, track your redemptions, find lounges, and more. Get started today at my.10xtravel.com or by clicking the link in the show notes. So with that aside, let's talk about safaris. So first and foremost, LaVon, could you give us kind of a quick high-level overview of the trip you just took? You know, what made you want to take this safari? How long have you been thinking about it? What was kind of the origin of that dream, if you will?
So it was actually a last-minute trip. My anniversary, or my wedding anniversary, is December 1st. And what we typically do with our best friends, they also have the exact same wedding anniversary. So we try to plan a trip together and then, you know, we'll go vacation together. They weren't able to make it. So we had to completely scrap the plans. And then I pivoted to the safari literally two weeks before the vacation. And I was able to pull it together. It actually wasn't really something that was like, you know, on my bucket list, something that I've been planning to do. It just kind of worked out. And then I said, all right, you know, let me see if I could try to pull this together. And luckily it worked out.
It's so funny how, you know, a safari is a trip that for most people, they're spending a long time planning and coordinating. But I feel as if that's just the almost stereotypical Points and Miles experience for everyone at some point is, I wasn't planning on going on safari, or I wasn't planning on going to Australia, or I wasn't planning on going to Japan, but you know, it just worked out. It just happened.
And this is why we always start each episode saying like, hey, go back to episodes 1 through 6. Cause I'm always worried that people are going to find this show and be like, oh, let's start with the safari episode. And within the first like 5 minutes, it's like, hey, here's LaVon. He travels all over the world on Points and Miles, super awesome lifestyle. Oh, by the way, booked a safari with 2 weeks notice. And they're just like, nope, definitely not me. And I'm for all you listening, you can get to that point. I guess some of you will. This is still rarefied air in the Points and Miles hobby, and very exciting to hear about. But 2 weeks of notice, that, I mean, even for me, someone who's traveled quite a bit, that gives me a little bit of anxiety about kind of planning all those pieces. There's a lot to know. So, you know, how did you kind of deal with that, LaVon? All the planning and put together of everything. It's so last minute, the visas, the booking of the lodge, travel to and from, like, you know, does that make you nervous at all? Or are you just kind of one of those very, very rare individuals who just like, nope, I got it?
So I think what kind of helped was about a month and a half prior to that, I took a trip to Europe just for the sole purpose of flying back to the States on Lufthansa first class. And in order to book it, you have to book it last minute. So I didn't know where I was going to be flying it from, whether that was from like Munich or Frankfurt. So that gave me like a little bit of taste of like just kind of walking on the edge, going with the flow, seeing what happens. So that definitely helped. But yeah, there was definitely a little anxiety because the visa, I remember the visa gave me some issues because it didn't come in until like almost last minute. And you know, that's kind of something you really want to have that locked down ahead of time. But I didn't get it until like 2 days before the trip. So I was sweating a little bit.
I would think so. Yeah. Did you have any other kind of initial concerns or hesitations about putting together a trip like this on such a short timeline? And you mentioned going with friends. Did you travel with just one other couple, or how did that kind of end up for you?
So because that couple dropped out, it was just me and Irene, my wife. So we just celebrated our 6th wedding anniversary by ourselves and had a great safari experience. But to go back to your question, I was a little worried about like the vaccinations. But after doing some research, getting into the weeds a little bit, like I did the safari was in Masai Mara and it's malaria free. So there wasn't really too many concerns there. That was probably the thing that I was concerned the most about. But once I was able to like get past that, it was honestly kind of smooth sailing.
Wonderful.
And of course, minus the visa, of course.
Yeah. Smooth sailing. Yeah. You know, 2 days prior to the trip, you could call it smooth sailing. And that works, I guess. I would have been sweating bullets. So you said you went to Masai Mara. That is in Kenya. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. Fantastic. Can you tell us about how you kind of settled on going to that location in particular? What other ones did you consider? I know you mentioned like the vaccinations and the malaria were kind of a factor. Kind of walk us through that decision process.
I guess what really happened was I knew I wanted to visit the continent of Africa. And it was just a matter of where. So initially I was looking at the Seychelles and I thought that would obviously have been a nice place. But then I got the idea like, you know, why don't I do a safari? So I knew there's a couple different areas where you can really get a great safari experience. Kenya is one, Cape Town or South Africa, Botswana. But I just ended up choosing Kenya. No, I think it was probably the award availability. I was able to find first class award availability on Emirates. And for me personally, especially during that time period of my travel, it was being almost fully dictated by award availability. If I can fly something really fancy and cool there, a new product, then that's just where I'm going.
Sometimes that's such a fun way to do it. Is
agreed.
Just, hey, this, I can get there on Emirates, so that's how I'm going to do it.
So you tell us, Levon, how did you end up booking this trip? What airline routing kind of points did you use? How did it all come together from that standpoint?
So my home airport at that time was JFK. So I was trying to find, you know, JFK to Dubai and then onward to Nairobi. But there was no award availability from JFK at all. So I was pivoting. I started looking at some repositioning options and then I found Toronto to Dubai. So just took a short flight. It was just, you know, I think of maybe an hour and a half from JFK to Toronto. Spent overnight at Toronto just to make sure that there wouldn't be any issues, no flight cancellation delays, and then went from there over to Nairobi. And yeah, the whole flight was booked in first class. So I got to enjoy, I believe it was like 27 hours of first class on Emirates. So that was really, really nice.
That's not bad at all.
Yeah. So to confirm, two separate legs. So Toronto to Dubai, Dubai to Nairobi, and both were on Emirates first?
Yes. I was initially just looking just to make sure to get the longest leg wasn't mm-hmm. first, but it wasn't much more to add that connecting itinerary. So yeah, at that point, I think it was about 30,000 more points. It was a no-brainer to just do both legs in first.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. How long is that flight from Dubai to Nairobi? four-ish hours, five?
It might have been seven or eight. Okay. I don't remember exactly, but it wasn't really a short, like a super short flight. So it made sense to get it in F.
You know, that American education system making me forget how large the continent of Africa is.
For sure. Every time I'm like guessing at what a flight, like an intra-Africa flight would be distance wise, I just double it. And it's like, that's way more accurate than my initial assumption is. It's just such a huge continent.
Let me ask you on your flight, Levon, you mentioned repositioning to Toronto, which I've become a huge fan of. For me, it's not Toronto, it's Mexico City, but doing this international repositioning feels so much more intimidating than repositioning within the US, which is so funny because you'll sometimes see people repositioning from the East Coast to the West Coast when going to Toronto is probably, well, it's almost certainly a much shorter travel time. But that was a little bit of a side quest there. But really what I wanted to ask you about was there a big noticeable difference in the taxes and fees out of Toronto versus the US, or was it kind of comparable to what you would have expected?
To be honest, like when you are booking Emirates First Class with Emirates points, you're going to kind of get hammered with taxes and fees if you're going through Dubai. Now, if you're doing one of the Fifth Freedom flights where you're not entering Dubai, like, you know, JFK to Milan or Newark to Athens, the taxes are going to be far, far less. But once you're touching Dubai, they're going to want a couple coins out of you. I believe it was comparable. I don't remember exactly now, but I think you're looking at about at least $600 to $1,000 per person.
Yeah, it's like it probably wasn't exact down to the cent, but it's less the originating in the US versus Canada and more the you're hitting Dubai.
Yep.
So they're hitting your pocketbook.
Yeah, and I guess we shouldn't skip over the question that everyone's thinking about right now. Do you remember how many points you paid for that flight, or either per passenger or for both of you?
Yes, it was 186,000 points per person. Plus around, it actually might have been a little bit north of 1,000. Not typically what I like to spend in taxes, but it was wedding anniversary trip. So let's splurge. Let's just do this thing right. That was exactly. And it was worth it. I don't think that's something that I would be doing every day, every year. But for the experience, I do think it's worth it. And it was, I don't regret it one bit.
Plus the last minute availability too. It's like you almost can't pass on something that works when you have all these timelines to manage.
Of course, exactly. My important question, was it the A380 or the 777?
So I definitely wanted to get the A380. I think that was another thing that kind of led into the decision to go from Toronto, just doing from some of the research. They had the A380, so you know, if you're going to do Emirates first, and if you can choose, you do the A380, you get the bar at the back of business class, and then, of course, the onboard shower. So, those were some huge driving factors in the decisions.
Absolutely. Was this your first time flying on that product?
Yes. That was my first time flying with Emirates at all.
Yep. So, no-brainer for all those reasons we just mentioned. That's well covered, of course, in previous episodes. The shower jokes have almost become like a cliche at this point, but like when you see the opportunity, you grab it. And you mentioned, Levon, 186,000 points per person. Those were presumably transferred from a major bank transferable program, or did you happen to have those already in like another program?
No, I transferred them over from a major bank, pretty popular bank. And luckily with Emirates, a lot of these flexible bank points do transfer over to Emirates. So even if you don't necessarily have all 180,000 in one program, you know, you can do something like 90 from one, 90 from the other.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yep.
Was for your flights, were there any other options that y'all were looking at or considering, or any tips or advice you can share with people looking to get to Africa for safari beyond just Emirates?
Qatar is another one where you can get to most parts of Africa. And of course, you get to go on the world's best business class. They just won it recently. Or I think it just announced a couple of days ago. They have again won world's best airline and world's best business class. So Qatar is another great option. Turkish Airlines is another option that will go to most parts of Europe as well, too.
And I believe that's how you flew home, right? Was it Turkish business class home?
Yes. So I wanted to try a different business class or a different, you know, hard product. At this point, I'm literally trying to fly each and every single one of them that I can while I can. So, yeah, that was another major determining factor in getting the ride home.
Gotcha.
And, of course, I'm maybe stealing something from Levon's playbook here. So correct me if I'm wrong, but if someone's wanting to do economy and maybe doing one of the South African safaris, Virgin Atlantic, great option there. Am I right, Levon?
Absolutely. Absolutely. There is, if you're wanting to save some points, the Virgin Atlantic program has to be looked at. We have a full step-by-step guide to teach you exactly how you're able to book that, because it is a little nuanced, a lot more complicated than a normal points booking, but you can get there for about 13,000 points from the East Coast in economy and 16,500 from the West Coast. And you just cannot beat that value. And even better than that, you can get premium economy for 26,000 to about 34,000, depending if you're leaving from the East Coast or West Coast. So that's a lot more comfortable, not much more points. So that's something you could really take advantage of.
I'm very much on team. Like, if I'm flying over an ocean, I need to lie flat. But when I hear that it's like literally 1/10 of the cost, if it's in an economy and you can find space, of course, to Virgin, which is never guaranteed, I'm like, I would consider that. That's an incredible deal.
It's certainly worth considering, because you literally cannot find value like that, I think, with any other points program for a flight that long. It just doesn't exist.
Yeah. And I'm also wondering, to kind of go back to the earlier point of like best business class and Qatar winning again, it's like, I feel bad for the folks at other airlines that have to like submit whatever application goes into that. It's like, okay, reasons why we're better than Q Suites. Let's think. Okay, none. Like, you know, like you can't even try to make that pitch when you just look at Q Suites. But yeah, shout out to all those who try.
It's almost like a race to second and third place at this point, it seems. Yeah, like.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So your flight home, Turkish Air business class, do you happen to remember like roughly what the total cost was? What was the routing home? How did the taxes and fees look? Did you consider that as an option on the way out?
Yes. So one of the things too that's really great about booking Turkish Airlines business class, and I believe it also applies to economy, you can add on a stopover in Istanbul, which is another really great country to get to explore. And you know, if you have the time, you could spend an extra 2 to 3 days before coming home or on the way to your destination to get to explore Istanbul. So that was one of the reasons that we did that. The points was 85,000 per person, plus about $400 in taxes and fees. But bear in mind, Turkish Airlines did a devaluation about a year ago. So now that trip would cost quite a bit more. So before the devaluation, they were just kind of, the award chart was a lot more favorable to connecting itineraries, but now it's additive. So if the leg over to Istanbul costs, let's say, 65,000, and then this other leg to complete the trip is another 65,000, you're paying both, where before it might have been 80,000, 90,000, 100,000.
Yep. It's another one of the add to the list of like, wow, that was really cool. And that's no longer kind of available for those who are listening. But still lots of different options to get there. Sounds like Virgin Atlantic is gonna be the one that most people are gonna start with for economy or premium economy. But of course, when we're talking about safaris, like, correct me if I'm wrong, gentlemen, but does it matter all that much when you get there and you're on safari? Like, that has gotta be the highlight of this trip, right? Usually with us points, people were talking about, it's like, hey, how was your trip? The first thing we talk about was like the flights to and from. But with Safari, I feel like that's a little bit different, right? Can you kind of talk to us about how you kind of thought through that. How much excitement was there around like the safari experience itself versus the travel, and how does this kind of compare to other trips from that dynamic?
Like you were touching on, like when you're at points of miles and you're able to fly business class, first class, or even you're getting a great lounge experience on the way, it's kind of like a trip within a trip. So that's always great. But yeah, the main star of the show is undoubtedly the safari experience. Because yes, a first class flight, you're in the air 14 hours and it's great. But I was on the safari for 3 days, 2 nights, and some other things as well too in Nairobi. And there's nothing that can compare to that. Like being out in the savannah where a lion and her cubs are literally like 5 feet away from you. You can almost smell their breath. Like that's one of those things that I'm for sure going to remember forever.
That's incredible. Yeah. So you said three days, two nights. I guess let's kind of move toward the safari part of that trip. Can you just kind of tell us about that time spent on the ground? You mentioned kind of the area that you stayed, but you know, what was it like after landing? What was that kind of went into choosing that trip? Were there any other potential options that you considered other than the one that you booked? And kind of what would you do potentially differently if you were booking all of that again?
Well, if I was booking it again, I would book it a lot further in advance.
Yeah. So I'm sure Irene would hop on here and be like, yes, please.
But yeah, so I wanted to spend, because there's just so many different safari options. You could do it as a day trip. You can spend a week. You can do 3 days. So I wanted to get enough time, but not spend too much time. Because, you know, obviously, if you do a longer safari, that's going to come with a little bit more coins coming out of the wallet. So I thought 3 days, two nights was a nice little sweet spot to like really get to enjoy it. So typically, when you book it or you negotiate it based on whoever you book it with, they'll pick you up from Nairobi, or you can like fly into a lodge, you know, just depending on what you're doing. And yeah, just even driving to the lodge, you're already kind of getting a game drive, because you're driving through. This is their habitat. It's their habitat. And then there's just a couple of roads, you know, in there for the safari trucks to go through. So while you're promised two game drives, you really kind of get four on 3 days, two nights. So that's something to consider as well. I think while it's nice to be able to just kind of fly into an airstrip, like on the JW Masai Mara, getting to drive in is honestly just as nice, because you're getting an extra game drive.
Yes. And of course, roads is kind of a very loose term at some of these safari lodges. And I don't think there's any pavement on a lot of these roads. I know for the safari that my wife and I went on 2019, the drive from the airstrip to the lodge was, you know, of course, all like dirt, I guess. Could you even call it dirt roads? It's more like paths.
Mm-hmm. It's like just like where this direction. The trucks have driven enough times to have exactly. a path.
Yeah, we went through like a river, and there were elephants there just like bathing. And you know, we got our luggage like in the back getting splashed by the water as we drive through. And we're just like, oh, this is fun and unexpected.
Yeah, driving on those roads, you will get what's called an African massage. There is no real great way to describe it. I just hope that you get to experience it at least once when you're on your way to a safari. It is worth it.
Yeah, absolutely. So for the booking of the safari that you chose, can you kind of walk us through that process? Like, where did you start? What did you, who did you end up kind of booking through? Any cost numbers that you're willing to share? Kind of, that's where a lot of people get hung up on this trip, because it is a little bit different than your traditional going to a city. We're going to book a hotel. We'll book like a ground transfer from the airport to the hotel. It's all a little bit more dicey, I guess, with safari. So how did that go for you?
Certainly. So there's a couple different ways. Probably the easiest way, but this is going to be the most expensive way, is by doing your safari through like a hotel program, like, you know, the JW, like you were just mentioning before. So they would be able to help take care of all your safaris, and they're complimentary from what I understand. But if you're going to do it a little bit more of an economical path, then you can use something like safaribookings.com, Viator, Get Your Guide. These are just these kind of like travel guide websites where you'll be able to look at reviews, kind of vet who you want to go with, and then just book it through them. And then they'll help you get your accommodations and everything in order. And that's the route that I took. I used Safari Bookings over the course of about 2 to 3 days. read through a bunch of reviews, tried to make sure you can get as good an experience as possible, see which like tour companies are really organized. That's the thing that you really want to pay the most attention to. Are they organized? Are they picking you up when they're supposed to pick you up? Is everything going as it's supposed to be going? And are you getting everything that you're promised? So I did that route, and the price was $750 per person for the 3 days and two nights. Wow. And I thought that was very good value, because I was looking at some of the other prices and it was quite a bit more, quite a bit more. So I was very happy with it. Service was excellent throughout. And I would definitely recommend, if somebody's looking to have a great experience, not break the bank too much, you can check out safaribookings.com.
I feel like that's really good advice, because a lot of times when people are talking about Safari, or like as someone who hasn't been on one, what I see about it is usually you can spend as much as you want. And knowing that there's options out there that aren't just at the extreme high end of the price point. You paid for 3 days what some people are paying per night
and more.
Yeah. And much more, yeah. so nice to know that it doesn't have to be a break the bank experience. And to just kind of confirm, was that including, you mentioned the transportation and the game drives, but that was accommodations, meals, or was that on top of the cost?
No, everything was included. Just the drive from Nairobi over to the camp, that's about 4 to 6 hours. Well, yeah, it's definitely like 5 hours, could be even six depending on traffic. And so you're getting both rides, the accommodation, food. So you're getting breakfast, lunch, dinner, the game drives. And you also get like your lunch for one of the days is like out in the savannah. So I think it's a really, really great value. You just got to make sure when you're vetting and you're doing your research, you get a company that's going to be able to take care of you like that, because that certainly does exist. It wasn't just that company that I booked with that offers that. There were quite a few that had that whole package deal.
Yeah, that seems to be a kind of a common thing with safaris. There's usually sticker shock with the price. And the one that you found sounds very, very reasonable. And like Travis mentioned, safaris are one of those things where like you can spend as much as you're kind of looking to spend. Like if you ask one of these companies, or if they ask you kind of like, what's your budget? There's no number that's going to shake them. Like if you said $200,000 for a week, they would have an option available for you that someone has booked within the last week. Like it's there. But everything is generally included in that price, in my experience. So do keep that in mind, folks, when you're booking safaris. This is going to cover your food, your transportation to and from. Really, I guess, Levon, did you have any kind of expenses outside of that $750 per person while you were on this trip? Or anything that kind of jumped out expense-wise that you weren't expecting?
Really, the only things, like if you wanted to, book like a massage or maybe get drinks from the bar, those would be, separate added-on expenses. But aside from that, you pretty much are given everything that you need. And if you want to do a little something extra, or like an air balloon ride, like over the safari, that's something that you can add on for an extra cost in your package. So it was like that kind of thing, but we were happy with what we had and totally satisfied.
Gotcha. And how does tipping work? Like, is there tipping expected above and beyond? Do you tip kind of each person that you encounter while there, or is that kind of baked into the price as well?
Well, I would say at the very least to come prepared to tip your driver, because your driver is going to be your best friend. Like, you're going to spend a lot of time with your driver in the ride there, in the ride back. All the game drives, they're kind of like not your butler, but they're like your best friend. They are part of your trip. So I would say at the very least to take care of them. And then of course you can also take care of any, the camp staff, whether that's the people that are cleaning the room or things like that. But at the bare minimum, your driver should be taken care of, I think.
driver is probably is definitely their technical job, but from my standpoint, when I'm out there, I'm like, you are my kind of guardian angel. You mentioned close enough to lions to like smell their breath. It's like, don't hesitate to tip the people who are trying to keep you alive in a place that might be a little bit more risky than most other travel destinations. And that's, yeah, that's wonderful advice. So we've mentioned game drives a few times. Tell us what those are like. Like when you're on the ground, when do they happen? What wildlife did you see in particular? What was some of kind of the highlights from those game drives for you?
Yeah, so once you enter into the gates of, you know, whether it's Masai Mara Park or Kruger or whatever game drive it is, and just getting to your camp, you're getting a game drive. So some of the animals that I saw was zebras, all different kinds of gazelles, elephants. Oh my goodness, I saw like a whole family of elephants. It was about maybe 20 to 30 of them, and they were just marching. They make sure to keep the young ones right in the middle so they're protected by the family. Tons of baboons and monkeys, lions, cheetahs. The only thing that I didn't see was leopards, because leopards are just really difficult to spot these days. Wildebeests, buffaloes, hippos. So really a little bit of everything. It was, I describe it as a National Geographic or like Our Planet, like one of those documentaries, but in real life. That's literally what it's like.
How close were you getting to kind of some of these animals? Like what were some of your closest encounters? And did you ever at any point feel kind of unsafe?
I wouldn't say unsafe, because and it also too depends on your safari vehicle. There are some that are open. I was in like a closed Jeep situation, so you feel a little bit better. But yeah, there was a pack of lions, and like they were literally like I could almost reach out and like pet it if I wanted to. Definitely wouldn't happen. But that's about how close I was.
Wow, that's awesome. What was if you can recall, what were kind of some of your favorite moments on those wildlife drives? You mentioned being close enough to a lion to kind of reach out and touch it. Did you see anything else that really just made you go, wow?
One of the times too, we just stopped because the elephants, they themselves had stopped, and they were kind of like bathing and rolling around in the mud. That's another thing too that your driver is going to do for you. He's also your guide, so he's going to be educating on you on what's happening, providing a bunch of context so you know what's going on. So the elephants were bathing in the mud to cool themselves off. It was a fairly hot day. And we were just watching a little baby elephant roll in the mud, play around, get up from the mud. So that was really cool and very memorable. I also really enjoyed, I actually tracked a male lion. They were kind of hiding throughout our safari drives. But I remember, like, you know, as we're driving, I'm looking just to see, like, hey, if I see something, you know, you're able to tell the driver or your guide to stop so you can get some pictures, videos. And I actually tracked the lion. I found it. We stopped and we got some pictures and videos of it. So that made me feel pretty cool. Wow. He said I was probably a tracker in my past life.
That's awesome. These game drives, so I assume there were probably other people with you while you were in the vehicle as well. Like how many others are along for the trip? Was it kind of the same group throughout? And when did these typically happen, like in a daily schedule?
So for this one, these were actually all private game drives. It was just me, my wife, and our best friend, Titus, who was our guide. So yeah, and so that's another thing too, for the price for a private game drive, that was really spectacular. But yeah, it was just us. But wow. The times were, you'll always do someone that's really early, because that's when animals are like really active, or you could do one that's really late, because again, that's when they're really active. They're not as active during the day. You'll see if you do a game drive in the afternoon, they're just kind of lounging around, literally just lounging around eating grass. And that's all they're going to do. But like hunts and activity and movement, those are going to happen early morning and really late at night.
Yeah, that was our experience as well. And that's something I think a lot of people miss about booking safari, is that if you're the type of person who wants to go on vacation and sleep in till 10 in the morning and or kind of lounge around in the evenings, like that's when the excitement happens. Like the lounging on safari tends to happen between like 11 a.m. and maybe 5 p.m., like at the actual lodge itself. So the sleep schedule is a little bit wonky, but when you're out there, I feel like the excitement is enough to get you up and out of bed and, you know, be within arm's reach of a lion. Like, that'll get most people up.
Oh, for sure. Definitely.
Sounds like one of those where you can sleep when you're home.
Yep.
Yeah, absolutely. Can you tell us about like the accommodations on like the camp itself? Like, what was your kind of room like? What was the entire complex like? How much did you encounter other people, meals, et cetera? Like, is there a traditional kind of like lobby that you go to for breakfast, lunch, and dinner? What's that experience like?
Yeah, they do such a good job of like turning, because it's, you're really outdoors, but they do a really good job of making the camp situation very comfortable. So it was literally a not necessarily a luxury camp. This was kind of like mid-budget, but it was very comfortable. You have your own room. There's a door. There's a shower. The only thing that you don't really have is like Wi-Fi. There isn't great Wi-Fi reception, but there is like a hotel lobby. There's kind of like a gathering kind of chill area where at least our camp did have some Wi-Fi. They have a dining area, and that's where you're going to typically see like other families, other couples that are also there on safari as well too. But yeah, they did a great job. It was, you literally have everything. You're not wanting for anything there.
And the place that you stayed in particular, was it kind of one contiguous building with all the rooms together, or were things kind of spaced out to where you had to kind of walk between to get to, you know, breakfast, if you will?
It's definitely spaced out, like between each housing or between each person's camp. There's definitely maybe, you know, 50 to 100 feet or not. I don't know. Maybe it's quite a bit spaced out where you're not really seeing anybody else.
Yeah, that was one of my experience. That was one of my favorite parts of it too. It's like, it's just a lot more kind of solitude and really just being in that space by yourself that kind of contributes to that experience of just, wow, like this is unlike anywhere else I've ever been. I have a deep sense that I am like here among the animals. And perhaps most importantly, like we are in their space. Like we are guests here. We're not even like the most dominant player on the plains at the moment. We are just not happy to be in that space and hopefully safe the whole time. I know for ours, it was similar. Everything was kind of spaced out a bit. And they had a rule at the camp where you can't lock your doors, because if someone ever sees like a threatening predator, like a lion, they need to run into the closest building. And if that happens to be your room, fine. But I just love that whole experience of just kind of being one with that space and sensing it.
Something that did remind me of though is like when it's nighttime, once it's dark, some hotel representative will walk you to your room just to like make sure everything is everything. If there is an animal that does happen to come on the grounds, they'll make sure to take care of you. So that really gave us a peace of mind.
Yeah, absolutely. I remember the same. And I remember thinking during that walk, like at night, they have a flashlight. I'm like, I'm glad that you're here. But if a lion shows up, what are you going to do? Like, you know, like, there's just going to be like one witness to the attack, potentially like call for help faster, but it's not like someone's going to jump in front and wrestle that lion as much as I like to think I could. The moment you see one of them, it's like no chance.
He had an interesting looking staff. I don't know how effective or great that would be, but at least it was something.
It's better, yeah. Better than a flashlight.
Right.
Yeah, and I actually recall when I was there, one thing that caught me off guard is I did ask one of the game drivers on our trip, like I said, what is actually like the most dangerous animal that's out here? Like what should we kind of be afraid of? Like this was like the first day, I'm still kind of in that like heightened senses, like stay alive type mode. And I was surprised that the answer was actually elephants. He said in his experience, like the incidents that they have and like the, in, you know, from his entire career, he said elephants are by far the most dangerous ones. I forget how he phrased it. Something about how like they know they could absolutely destroy you if they had to. And in some cases, they almost view it as like an inconvenience. So they look like these fun, kind of happy, cute creatures that we see in Disney movies kind of growing up. But he's like, those are the ones you actually really want to watch out for, especially when they get close to your camp. And, you know, being in a vehicle or something might not necessarily offer the safety that most of us would love to hear when you're talking about something that is probably four times the size of a Jeep with big giant tusks.
And hippos are no walk in the park either. Mm-hmm. I think you can actually attribute the most like deaths to humans. It's typically by a hippo.
Yeah, and of course, hippos can kind of submerge themselves in water and be a little bit more of a surprise, I think, whereas elephants have a hard time hiding on the plains. So let's kind of pivot to like the points angle. Levon, in your kind of research and booking this, were there any options to use points for safari lodges themselves or kind of more generally in the experience that you've seen among our readers here at 10X, or is that something that folks should just plan on paying cash for?
Personally, I would say that for safaris, the actual safari booking, unless you're booking with Marriott points or the JW, it's probably something you should probably budget cash for. There are very few options. You could either kind of do some type of pay yourself back situation, or with Virgin Red, there are a couple safaris that you can do with points, but they're typically like, I think it's north of 200,000 or maybe 300,000 points per night, something like that. So you would really need to kind of be swimming in points to kind of like make that work.
Well, we do have our resident swimming in Marriott points host here with Travis, or at least status and experience with that. So I guess I'd ask you, Travis, have you ever considered using like that many Marriott points for something like this, or is that even kind of beyond? Okay.
I've had my eye on, Levon mentioned the new, or it's maybe not new anymore, but when the JW Masai Mara opened, and there's now the new Ritz-Carlton one opening up, I've had my eye on them. I know at least at the JW, like the award availability has been pretty tough to come by. There's a lot of people watching it and waiting to grab it whenever they can. So I think the Ritz-Carlton one might be a little bit better in terms of availability, but that's only because at least when they originally started taking bookings, which was maybe just a few months ago, it was 280,000 points per night. So that's a little bit of a bummer that it's priced so steep. I've wanted to, but now I might dig in to some of the Virgin Red ones because I have a couple hundred thousand Virgin points from when I had booked my Japan trip for 2020. So still been sitting on those for 5 years now trying to figure out what to do with them. So
that would be a good use, I think.
I literally already opened the tab to go.
I was gonna say,
look at the options and see what those look like. So Murray and I've been talking about doing a safari maybe in the next year or two. So that's a good tip there. But in general, I've probably expected, like both of you said, to go into it probably having to pay cash instead of using points, which it just sometimes is what it is with some experiences. You know, safari, Antarctica, Galapagos are all those experiences where it's not impossible to do it with points, but it's
almost
almost. Yeah.
Yeah. I'll save you some of the time, Travis. I ran a quick award search for that new Ritz-Carlton and I think Levon mentioned the price, and you're about right. It was about 280,000 points per night. Award availability was reasonably wide open, especially given that is opening in August. Mm-hmm. So it's new, it's exciting, it's been all over social media. The cash price is a little under 4,000 points per night, but from a cents per point valuation, it was like 1.1 to 1.3 cents per point for Marriott, which is not bad, but you do have to redeem potentially like multi seven figures of points to book a stay. And that is just for their kind of like base level room, if you will. But hey, for a cents per point standpoint, I don't know if you can get much better out of Marriott than that. But on a cash basis, it's a little under 4,000 points per night. So this is definitely not going to be one of those trips that you book with points and come home and tell your friends about how you went on safari on points and you only spent $400 out of pocket. Like, no chance. I want to kind of circle back to some of those kind of practical considerations that we were talking about earlier, Levon, with like the visas, the entry requirements, like the vaccinations and such, because this is another component that you do have to think about when booking safari And in a lot of cases, you do have to have this in place ahead of time. It's not like you can skip that and just show up and be like, yeah, you know, I don't have a visa, but I'm just, let me in anyway. Like, you don't want to be stuck in the airport not being able to go on that expensive safari. So I guess, Levon, you mentioned that, or no, you did get the visa set up. Do you happen to know kind of the high level details of how those work for visiting Kenya?
So you need to or should trying to get your visa set up, I would say, maybe a week and a half in advance, just to make sure, because it takes, I think, at minimum 3 days to make that come back. So you want to give yourself enough time so you're not sweating bullets like I was at the end there. You also want to check to see, based on the safari that you're going to, is it an area where malaria is present? Because then you definitely want to make sure that you have the proper immunization set up. You definitely don't want those problems. So I think those two, if you can get those two details buttoned up, everything else is quite a bit simpler to handle.
Absolutely. Yeah. The four most popular countries from my perspective for doing safari, you have Kenya where Levon went, and that is easily becoming like the hottest, most popular of the four. South Africa would probably be right there at number two. That one does not need a visa if you're staying for under 90 days. And you do have multiple options that would have malaria or non. Like in our case, we went to Madikwe National Park, which is way up in the north side of the country. No malaria to be concerned of there, but Kruger, which is perhaps the single most popular safari destination, that one would have malaria present. Some of them will require that you get a vaccine for yellow fever ahead of time. Some will recommend it. But these are all things that you do have to kind of have in place before you show up. This is a little bit more nuanced than your typical travel destination. For that, among other reasons as well. And then, of course, there's the travel insurance component to think about as well. Did you buy any insurance for your trip, Levon? And if so, could you kind of walk us through how you thought about that and what you ended up going with?
Yes, I pretty much, I have Safety Wing insurance year-round. I pay for that monthly because I'm always traveling. So I just pay for that every month, and any emergencies, any kind of urgent care, hospital situation, I have peace of mind that I'll be protected there, or covered rather.
Yep. In case you reach out, pet that line a little too closely and come home with, you know, one less arm than you went there with. It's like, yay, I have insurance. All is good. Minus the fact that I'm missing an arm, but
through the story, yeah, I suppose. I always, as someone who is, you know, maybe doing more adventure travel, you know, not the craziest adventure travel,
says the guy who regularly dives like 200 feet below the ocean.
Yeah, I'm talking about like people like hiking up in the mountains of Nepal and stuff, or, you know.
Still not crazy in my perspective. You are the crazy, like the most adventurous traveler that I've probably ever met. So
definitely. I'm right there with you, Bryce.
Yep.
I always, you know, even though my credit card technically has that insurance, it's the peace of mind anytime that there's some adventure travel, having that additional travel insurance. It's funny because I've never had an issue with any of my credit card travel insurance claims, whether it's bag delays or trip cancellation interruption, even rental car, all of those, no problem. But when it comes to, you know, some of the medical evacuation policies, when you're in more remote or adventurous areas, is when I get a little bit more hesitant to rely just on that. So my recommendation, having not been on safari, for anyone, is get some. It's fairly affordable, so it's just some additional peace of mind.
And do make sure that it does cover safari type activities. I know a lot of those policies, especially like the annual ones or kind of like the recurring blanket ones, will have specific exclusions for things like this. So you want to make sure that you are indeed covered in the event that something happens. And hopefully it's minor enough that you're thinking about, can I open a card really fast to hit a minimum spend for this private helicopter transport out of the safari area in which I was just injured? You know, but, you know, it can happen. And at the very least, like having that peace of mind when you go into it is certainly going to help you enjoy your vacation a little bit more once you're there. Levon, on your trip, did you encounter any of the other kind of typical kind of travel frustrations around like paying for things, language barriers, kind of cultural differences, or anything like that folks should know before they consider taking a trip like this?
So having been to Kenya, South Africa, some of these major safari destinations, there's plenty of English speakers. Honestly, that was one of those trips where there wasn't really language barrier issues. It was very easy. Payments was very good too. Pretty much everyone took some kind of card or something like that. So that was an issue too. And if not, getting cash. I don't know if you guys have shared like a Charles Schwab investor checking account to get your ATM fees reimbursed. If you're doing any kind of international travel, I feel like that's a card that just has to be in your wallet because, you know, the easiest way to get foreign currency is going to the ATM. And if you know you're getting that back at the end of the month, then it just makes things so much simpler.
Is it a free checking account? That's not a credit card for people, but that's a free one. Anyone can go and open it to be able to do those foreign ATM withdrawals and getting those like ATM fees reimbursed plus, you know, typically better conversions and stuff. Is that all right?
Yep. I don't think there's like even like a minimum amount you need to keep in the account or anything that you need to do special to keep it free. It's free to open, free to use. It's just a no-brainer to have.
Yeah, I always kind of chuckle at this too, and I want to kind of briefly acknowledge that we're, you know, Points and Miles podcast, here we are talking about checking accounts on this Safari episode, but this is important. So hang with us, readers. That Schwab investor checking account is like, I don't understand why everyone just doesn't use it, period. Even if you've have no intent of traveling internationally, no fees, no of any kind, really. ATM withdrawals are free. They refund your the ATM fees. Like, even if you're like going to Vegas, where, you know, the ATM fees are now like $15 per withdrawal, like that saves you quite a bit of money. But, you know, that's who I bank with. And I feel like every time I travel abroad, I feel like someone with like the international phone plan that has like no restrictions at all. Like, I don't even think about it. Like, I don't think like, oh, what's different because I'm abroad? It's just kind of the same way that you bank while at home. But how about like packing tips? Did you feel like you kind of adequately planned for that? What advice do you have for others? As well as like kind of from a photography standpoint, I imagine that you wanted to kind of get some great photos there. So what advice would you have for folks who are planning on packing for a safari?
So packing, the weather, it's going to be, it's fairly easy to pack for a safari trip because you're kind of going to be in like a t-shirt situation, shorts, or maybe some comfortable cargo pants. So it's pretty easy to pack. You could honestly probably get away carry on. I know that's probably a little hard for some folks to manage, but if you're just, you know, check bag, carry on, check bag, book bag, you're solid. You'll have everything you need. Some things that you are going to want to bring, though, I would say some kind of ear plug or noise canceling headphones. Because if you're on safari, the animals, they wake up around 4 a.m., 5 a.m. and they're talking. So if you don't have some kind of like ear plug, noise canceling headphones, and you're a light sleeper, forget about it. They're going to wake you up for sure. So I packed headphones. I also had like a little speaker to just play some kind of, you know, waves just to like drown out the sound of the animals. So that was really helpful. That's like a big one I would recommend. Sunscreen, things like that, and some bug spray for sure. You'll want some bug spray.
Yeah, retweet to that one. The bugs in most areas you'd want a safari are pretty intense, and to not be without spray would be deeply uncomfortable. And one other thing I think that folks often miss about safari bookings is that there is quite a bit of seasonality to it. Like there's times where you go and you'd be much more likely to have a better experience from like a wildlife, you know, viewing. And there are times that are not. So I guess, Levon, do you have any insight as to that? Like, when are the best times to kind of go? Does that vary based on kind of which region that you're going to be traveling in? And when did you go and how was that experience?
I went in December, and I think that I'll start with this. The best time to book would be during the Great Migration. That's when there's going to be a really big influx of animals. You're going to pretty much get to see everything. They're going to be really active. But for that time period, because it's such in demand, you're going to end up paying a little bit more. So if you're okay with those prices, that would be the best time to book. Another great time to book would be like a shoulder season situation. When in December, and there were still plenty of animals, still plenty of opportunities for videos and clips and being able to watch them in their habitat. There's not really a bad time really to book. Like, no matter when you go, you're going to be able to see animals. And even if it's raining, they're at, just the way they behave changes, so it's still going to be a unique experience. So based on what the guy shared with me, he said, anytime you come, you're going to have a great time. But if you can choose, then great migration would probably be the best.
Do you know off the top of your head what time of year that is?
That's typically somewhere between like July to September, if I remember correctly.
That would explain my experience as well. When I pulled up the Ritz-Carlton one earlier, it like defaulted to some dates in August, which might be around the time when this episode is airing. It's June right now, outing us again. We got some calendar issues with vacation over the summer in July, so we're getting ahead of things on our recording schedule with this one. But that explains why when I looked it up, it was like $7,000 a night, and I was like, whoa, yeah. That's but that's probably right in the middle of the Great Migration, it sounds like.
Yeah, that tracks.
Yeah,
I saw that as well in my research. It's like, wait, the 1 week prior is three times more expensive than the one after, and it's like, wait. So I guess that does kind of make it easy for you listeners when you're booking, if you're looking at prices and you see like, oh wow, this week is, you know, 1/8 of the price of all the other ones around it, do give a little bit of research to determine why that might be, so that you don't end up going all the way to Africa for safari and it's like, yep, this is nap season, all the animals are hiding, and we're gonna drive around and maybe see a couple of them. Something else to keep in mind as well, and that's true of course of many destinations. I'm seeing all over social media right now all the folks who are down in Mexico and even parts of Florida that walk out to the beach and it's just completely covered with seaweed. I'm talking like 2 feet of accumulation of seaweed. So not all that different from other places, but something to keep in mind as well. Are you gentlemen ready for a quick lightning round of questions here as we kind of get to the end of this episode?
Let's do it.
Okay. All right. I'm just looking for some kind of like rapid fire responses to some of these. There really many of them are going to be kind of like statements, but we wanted to kind of address these. And Travis, I know you haven't been on safari yourself, but you've seen a lot of folks book these. You used to run our award booking service here in the early days of 10X, so feel free to weigh in as well. So first one, safaris are only for rich people.
Definitely not. I went, and I can assure you, I am not loaded with money, so you can cross that one off.
Yep. I completely agree. As we talked about earlier in the episode, there are plenty of rich people safaris out there to be had. And of course, that perception is very common, but safaris have become much more popular and approachable for the average person. Next one, you need a week off of work to make it worthwhile.
I would say, because one, it's going to be a long flight. You probably want 5 to 6 days really to kind of like make it work. Think about a day or two at the beginning and the end, and then like your 3 days of safari. So if you have 5 or 6 days, you can certainly have a great safari experience.
Yeah, I'd agree. You don't necessarily need a lot of time, but between the travel time, as well as just being sure you have enough time on the ground, you probably need right at a week minimum.
I would agree too. It seems like safaris and particularly game drives have very much like an 80-20 dynamic where in the first day or really in 1 day at any safari, you're going to see 80% of the things that you expect to see: elephants, giraffes, probably a lion, like very impressive stuff. If you are really hoping to hit like the, I think it's the big five, or like see maybe like a cheetah or some of the more rare animals, that might take a few different drives, but it's not like you're going to go there and like, wow, we didn't see anything at all. So I think it can be done in any time frame. How about this one? Safaris are dangerous.
No, these guides, like my guy Titus, he had been doing game drives for like 20 years, and that's going to be pretty constant. They do a lot of training. There's a lot of things behind the scenes to make sure that you're safe. So I wouldn't say it's dangerous.
Yeah, I think self-guided safari, probably very dangerous. But as long as you're traveling with a good guide, a Titus, if you will, seems to be much more much more approachable. Safaris require special gear and clothing.
Oh, not really. You could just come as you are. You could, if you want to go in a suit, you could do that. If you want to have shorts and a t-shirt, you can do that. Like, you're going to be in the safari vehicle, have some bug spray, but yeah, you can, you don't really need anything special.
I agree. The flights to get to a safari are impossibly expensive. Says people who never heard of points and miles.
If you watch our video on how to get to South Africa for, you know, 13,000 to 16,000 points, you can, and then not to mention, if you sprinkle a transfer bonus on that, mm-hmm. you know, you're talking about 10,000 to 12,000 points to travel, you know, 15 to 17 hours to South Africa. So no, it's very affordable points wise.
Yeah. I think one of the bigger challenges is not expense. It's just like with anywhere you're going to be award availability. There's limited direct flights between the US and Africa. You know, United and Delta fly to South Africa. United has upped a few of their flights to Africa in general. You have Ethiopian Airways is probably a pretty decent option in terms of that availability. Or Egypt Air as well tends to have some pretty decent availability. Otherwise, kind of like Levon said, you're probably going through the Middle East or maybe even Europe to make it happen. So expensive, no. Convenient and award availability might be the bigger challenge.
And of course, remember our newly created rule of double the anticipated flight time. This isn't one of those continents where, like Europe, where it's like, well, if I can just get to any capital in Europe, then I'll just book an easy flight to hop to my final destination. No, you might be like halfway there when you get to Africa. Okay, so that was lightning round. And then a couple of quick questions here at the end here for Levon. What if anything, would you do differently next time you return to safari? And I guess piggybacking on that, did you have any interest in doing another safari or doing it again?
I definitely would do another one. I've gotten quite a little bit better at videography, so I would love to do one with a real zoom lens and things like that, and just get some more content to come back with just for the memories. But I would try Botswana. So a lot of the people, now that I've done a couple of safaris since then, even beyond the one in Kenya, the one that people say is the best is the one in Botswana. So I would love to go do a safari there to kind of see the difference and get to experience that.
Yeah. Botswana was definitely not on my list until, of all places, my Antarctica trip. Our expedition leader in the off season from Antarctica, she runs safari trips in Botswana, and seeing some of her pictures was just this looks incredible. I think it's here in the US, it's one that, like you mentioned, is not typical for us to think of for safari, but worth putting on the list.
The people in the know, they just keep saying it's the best one, so I'm gonna go with their judgment.
I hear all the same things too. It seems like everyone thinks South Africa first when you say safari, but when you encounter folks who've actually been on them before, they'll often say, no, like Kenya, Botswana, those are the places that are kind of emerging as popular destinations. And that's where I would probably go back to if I were to do another one. And my next question was, where's next on your Africa list? But it sounds like we've answered that one with Botswana. I guess one other to layer on kind of a family travel perspective here, one thing we did not address, I want to make sure to say, is that you do want to make sure that whatever you're booking does allow children. I know a fair number of these safari experiences do not, mainly from, at least it's explained to me, a safety perspective around, I forget how they phrase it, but it was pretty morbid. It was like, oh yeah, they view adults as kind of like non-threatening, like other beings on the planes, but children look like prey. And I'm like, oh, that's all you have to say. Like, I get it now. So this isn't Disney World. Don't show up and expect that your family can just roll in. Any other, advice generally before we kind of close here, Levon, for the many people who are interested in booking safaris, either from a points and miles standpoint or otherwise, what should they know about the trip? How excited should they be if they actually have one coming up here soon? And any kind of closing thoughts that you want to share?
if they have one coming up soon, they should absolutely be excited. If you've never done one before, it's one of those things that it lives up to the hype in full. So they should be very excited about that. It's still to this day one of my favorite and best travel experiences. And for other tips, there's so many options. You know, whether you're doing a safari in Kenya, South Africa, Botswana, just start researching, get everything together, and go have a blast. It'll be a memory that you literally won't soon forget.
Yep, and to add on to that, I completely agree. It seems like of the many situations where I've seen readers take a safari trip, I can't think of a single instance in which someone came back and they're like, yeah, it was just okay. I don't know if I'd do it again. They all seem to love it, even though it's expensive, even though it's going to, if you're using points, cost quite a few bit more points and be more difficult from a award booking standpoint. This certainly is a situation where you should consider hiring our award booking service. I know it feels self-promotional, but like this is a more nuanced booking where you're going to be spending a lot of points. Getting the experts in there is going to help quite a bit. But it's something where I would say, like, if you're on the fence, do it. Like, you're going to love it. You're going to have a great experience. You're going to be right up close and personal with wildlife. You're going to see a part of the world that you probably have never been to before that's quite different from anything else you've ever experienced. And you're just going to have an absolute blast with everything, the moment, really, depending on how you fly there, from the moment you get in the plane or from the moment you get there, but it's going to be a great time.
What I can say is, just from having this conversation and someone who hasn't been, I've got like a dozen tabs open now that's going to consume the next hour of my life.
You know, maybe we don't need to keep all those Marriott points. What if we just blow all of them on a trip to Botswana?
Do it.
That's wonderful advice. All right, let's wrap it up here. For those of you who are looking to make your safari trips happen, or any trips with points and miles, the best place to start is My10X. That's our single tool that helps make all this easier, help you save money on travel by getting more out of your points and miles. You can sign up for free right now by going to my.10xtravel.com or clicking the link in the show notes. I want to give another shout out that this was a topic that was recommended by a reader. I'm going back up here. It's Sophia S. We appreciate you sharing this topic with us. For others, if there's another topic that you want us to explore, please let us know in the comments of YouTube or any of the podcast libraries that you're using to listen to this, or in our Facebook group, which is the largest points and miles group on the planet. Just under 400,000 people in there. I imagine by the time this airs, we'll be well past 400,000. And of course, be sure to brush up and enroll in our free course that's within My10X. It'll teach you all the basics of how to start to put together trips like this, save quite a bit of money, make that a possibility for you and your family. Go out there, get within arm's reach of a lion. Make sure you get travel insurance first, but you will save money on that and have a much better experience overall. So an African safari might seem like an impossible dream, but as Levon just told us today, way more accessible than you think, thanks to points and miles. The hardest part is just deciding to book it. So Levon, appreciate you coming on here with us today. Travis, and for all of us here at 10X Travel, this has been Takeoff, a points and miles podcast by 10X Travel. We'll catch you next time. Bye now.